Okay, yeah, thank you very much for giving me the chance to speak here. So what I'm going to do is to, in a certain way, discuss or continue the discussion of by Bert yesterday. And okay, as Bert has already told you, there is was in a sense some transition in heterotic model building, in the sense that one went from so-called quasi-realistic models to potentially realistic models. What that means is that in the past we had models which had certain appealing features but were nevertheless immediately ruled out, and now we have models which we simply do not understand well enough in order to be able to really rule them out. So, like, please remember the discussion during Bert's talk yesterday. And actually, now in the time of LHC, the obvious next step would be to come up with real predictions to really explore these constructions and have something non-trivial to say for the LHC. So this would be the real hope in this whole business. So if you can make a real prediction which is confirmed at LHC, this would be, of course, the greatest thing. Probably it won't happen, but at least you can dream that this might happen. So the strategy how to come up with certain predictions like that would be to first identify a setting or model that is really consistent with observation, and then to understand it better. So what are the couplings, what are the further properties, because it's a string model, and then to really solve the open questions of particle physics within this model. And maybe this will lead to some non-trivial predictions that can be tested, like what is the scale of supersymmetry breakdown, how can that be explained, maybe there's no supersymmetry at all, I don't know. If you stick to supersymmetry, and that's what I'm gonna do here, so I will mainly focus on MSSM models, you wanna have a solution of the so-called MSSMU problem in this setting, you wanna solve the strong CP problem, and so on and so on. And in this talk, the main strategy to address all these questions will be symmetries. So, and this brings me in a certain way to the comparison to Bert's yesterday talk. What I'm going to discuss here is orbifold compactifications of the heterotic string. So in a sense, I will go from the heterotic string in 10 dimensions directly to 4 dimensions by a string compactification, and then we'll have a 4D orbifold vacuum. The discussion yesterday by Bert was, in a sense, and this is just a naive cartoon, I apologize for that, different. So he, in a sense, started with supergravity in 10D and then compactified on a nice Calabi-Yau manifold and got a 4D Calabi-Yau vacuum. And in many cases, you can, as you probably know much better than I do, blow up orbifold vacua, blow up orbifolds, and also get some Calabi-Yau or partially Calabi-Yau vacuum. But the main point which I want to stress here is that orbifolds in a certain way are symmetry-enhanced points in field space, and one may really use the symmetries of orbifolds in order to address fundamental questions of particle physics. So this will be the main message of this talk. So actually this has certain advantages, and the symmetries which appear here can be advantages. So what I will use here is exact and approximate symmetries which are in appear in these models, and I will focus on a subset of open questions. So first of all, one question will be, what is the origin of the hierarchically small scale of supersymmetry breakdown? Then I will briefly discuss the MSSM mu term, which is related to the first question. I will discuss meta parity. Yesterday we had a discussion already, so how can we distinguish between Higgs and lepton doublets in the MSSM? I will discuss SUSY flavor structure. So often it is claimed that if you have something like what is called gravity mediation, there's a SUSY flavor problem, but this is not necessarily the case. Proton stability will be an issue which I will try to address. Okay, these are the issues, and the outline of the remainder of this talk is, first I will discuss discrete asymmetries and the role of these discrete asymmetries in order to explain a small gravitino mass and a suppressed mu term. Actually, it turns out that these symmetries allow to solve or address both questions simultaneously. And then I will discuss other discrete symmetries, which are in a certain way remnants of original orbifold symmetries, which can be used in order to solve Susi flavor problems as well as proton decay problems, which are often appear in such models. And then I will summarize.
You are not interested in the textures per se so much. You want to demonstrate this phenomenon?
Yeah, this is related, of course. This is related, and yeah, and please interrupt me at any time. I mean, this is actually related. So proton won't decay in the top quark, right?
So proton
won't decay in the top quark. So actually, once you know what the flavor structure is and why some families are heavy and so on, you can solve the proton decay problem. You might not switch off QQQL operators, for instance, completely, but you just switch off the dangerous ones where just light generations are involved. So of course, the first step is to identify who is light, who is heavy, what is the flavor structure, and so on. And then in the second step, you can address the question.
Is one experimental data that we do?
Sure, sure. I fully agree. And okay, I didn't put it on the list, but this is of course the first obvious step. I mean, if you have a model where the top quark turns out to be ultra light, I think you can just stop. I will discuss, for instance, top mass and other things in an example. I fully agree.
Are you more interested in the general framework of this compactification or concrete realizations? Because some of this idea are conceptual issues within certain framework that you could demonstrate it works.
Well, I'm interested in both. I mean, I'm of course interested finally in having a model which is predictive, which is not ruled out, and which gives me new predictions for the LHC. This is my dream. And the framework which I'm going to use to address or to potentially be able to get such a model is heterotic orbifolds. Now, we were playing with these things for quite some time and found some interesting features which I want to discuss now, which are in a sense general or generic to all these constructions. So we have, I don't know, a few hundred of models, but they have certain common features, and the strategy is to first discuss the common features, and then in the end, if I have time, I will present one model where these are realized. Yeah? So this is not, I mean, this is not just some generic discussion without examples. We do have examples, but I start now with the general features, and then in the end, maybe I discuss one example. Okay, so first question is, and how to obtain, in a sense, the weak scale. How can we explain a small gravitino mass in such models? And as you know, there are many interesting possibilities, which are warping, non-perturbative effects, and so on. Here, I will discuss an alternative. And the alternative is that small expectation values, vacuum expectation values of the perturbative superpotential can be a consequence of approximate asymmetries. I think many of these things might be well known, although I didn't find this too explicitly in the literature, but I will now discuss very basic field theory, which will simply demonstrate that you can, in the presence of an approximate asymmetry, have a very much suppressed superpotential vacuum expectation value, which is the first step to explain a very low gravitino mass. So, the first statement which I would like to prove is that if you have an exact asymmetry, then at points where the global Susi F-term equations are satisfied, the superpotential vanishes. Yeah, this is a global F-term equation, vacuum expectation value of the superpotential. And then, as a consequence, in a sense, I want to prove in the second step, or just show, that if you have an approximate asymmetry, then this statement is approximately true, that at this point the superpotential is not really zero, but it goes like a typical vacuum expectation value of the fields to the power n, where n is the order at which the asymmetry is explicitly broken. Okay, first step, simple, could be written already in Wessenberger, I think. If you have superpotential, which is a polynomial in certain fields with certain coefficients, and you assume that it has an exact R symmetry. That is, the superpotential transforms with certain R charge under continuous transformation, and the fields have some R charges, small rj, and they transform in such a way that each of these monomial has a total R charge 2, that this is true. Now you look at the configurations where the F-term, the global F-term equations are satisfied. So this is true in this configuration. And look at the infinitesimal transformation of the superpotential. This is this one. You find, of course, that simply since this is true, zero, the superpotential goes into itself. On the other hand, it should transform non-trivially because it's an asymmetry. And the only way that both statements can be true at the same time is that superpotential vacuum expectation value is zero. I'm sure, I'm aware that there are other ways to prove this, but this is maybe the simplest one. So we find that at points where global F-term equations are satisfied, superpotential vacuum expectation value in the presence of a global U1R symmetry vanishes. This statement doesn't depend on whether this U1R is broken or unbroken in this field configuration. And when I gave similar talks before, people often criticized me that, of course, there is this Nelson-Seiberg theorem, which in a certain way would, as people sometimes claim, tell us that in the presence of a U1R symmetry, you cannot have supersymmetric ground states. This is actually not true. The Nelson-Seiberg theorem tells us that if you want to have a setting without supersymmetric ground state, and if this is generic and so on, you have to have a U1R symmetry. On the other hand, the opposite is not true. So you can have a U1R symmetry and you can have supersymmetric ground states nevertheless. And in, actually, in all the examples which we found in our orbifold compactifications, we always find supersymmetric ground states for some reason.
Are there some issues of global versus supergravity?
Yeah, this is next statement. If we have such a situation, global U1R symmetry would imply that vacuum expectation value of the superpotential vanishes too, right? And this simply means that the supergravity F terms are also zero. There's no, it was automatically solved in a sense.
If some of these fields are charged under the R parity,
excuse me?
Scalar fields, if some of the scalar fields are charged under R parity, under this, on that R parity, it's R symmetry.
Yeah.
So you have some of that scalar fields. I mean, these things get a bad break the symmetry, so radiative corrections will lift some of this, will it not?
Well, at that point, we have still supersymmetry, right? Supersymmetry is unbroken at that point.
Yeah.
So I don't see why the.
But when you break. Well,
sure. I mean, once you break supersymmetry, we do now step by step.
You're going to say you break it in a little scale, so then.
Yeah, but at that stage, supersymmetry is completely unbroken. So there's no radiative correction as far as I know. Okay. So now assume that this is not. The situation is slightly different, namely that there is explicit asymmetry breaking at some high order in this monomial. So they are at some high orders in this superpotential. At certain order n, there's explicit asymmetry breaking terms. If this is the case, certain obvious problems are automatically avoided, namely for continuous U1R symmetry. We would, of course, spontaneously break, or could spontaneously break this U1R symmetry, but this would lead to the so-called R axion, which is phenomenologically dangerous or really problematic. On the other hand, if this R symmetry is only approximate, this is only an approximate Goldstone boson, and simply it attains a mass. And what is further also clear, what you expect is that if the symmetry is only approximate and is broken at explicitly at some order n, the superpotential expectation value is no longer exactly zero, but also goes like phi to the order n. And as long phi is in a certain way small, this will lead to a very much suppressed or suppressed vacuum expectation value of the superpotential.
When it's broken at very high order, and your Goldstone's mass would be dangerously low.
Yeah, yeah, this, I will...
balancing those things may be a tricky way of...
No, it turns out that this is automatically fine, so we reject it, of course, and I will comment on that in a second. This is a, of course, you should worry about that, but it turns out that this Goldstone mode is even a bit heavier than the vacuum expectation value of the superpotential or the gravitino mass. You should worry about that, you should check, but we found that this is not really a problem. But before discussing this, let me just mention that obviously approximate U1 asymmetries can be in consequence of exact discrete
Then you have domain walls, if that's an exact discrete symmetry.
Domain walls?
Yeah.
I don't see any problem with domain walls, but maybe we can discuss.
Cosmological problems.
Okay, maybe we can discuss that privately. I don't see any problems with domain walls. But okay, let's know, this is just a comment that if you have the symmetries, then you can have approximate asymmetries. And okay, and you can study field theoretical examples. But simply, since this is a string workshop, I'm more interested in string-derived examples.
I have a very naive question for
yes.
this order N. Do you have some kind of limits how small or big it should be?
I will discuss that in a second when I come to explicit string theory realization. So, as I told you, approximate continuous U1 asymmetries can be a consequence of discrete asymmetries. And now, orbifolds are in a sense tailor-made for obtaining exact discrete asymmetries. And the reason is that, at least in the context of orbifold compactifications, this exact discrete asymmetries appear as remnants of the original Lorentz group. So you have a Lorentz group of internal six dimensions, and by orbifolds break this explicitly down to discrete subgroups. And the reason is that orbifolds only allow or are symmetric under discrete rotations, but no longer under continuous rotations. So this is well known, and you obtain simply discrete asymmetries. And for instance, we have been playing a long time with the so-called C6-2 orbifold based on factorized metori, in which case you get an asymmetry which is as large as C6 times C3 times C2. And okay, now in what follows, I will discuss certain examples of which really answer Gabriele's question. So, what is the power n at which the continuous U1 asymmetry is explicitly broken? And to do so, I focus on not just arbitrary models, but models with arbitrary features, which I will not discuss in great detail here. But we have found order 100 MSSM models, which have certain very attractive features. First of all, we get meta parity in these models as a subgroup of a U1 B-L, but this B-L symmetry is not contained in SO10. It's not even contained in the first or visible E8 factor. It is somehow a linear combination of many U1s. These models have the chiral MSSM spectrum and one pair of Higgs fields. We can distinguish Higgs from leptons by meta parity, and further, all exotic states can decouple once certain singlet fields attain vacuum expectation values. Because of this, these models are consistent with MSSM gauge coupling unification. We can have precise MSSM spectrum, therefore MSSM gauge coupling unification.
If you had a bunch of vector
yes.
pairs, right?
As long as they are heavy enough, there's no problem.
Well,
and I will discuss an example.
Some non-perturbative examples. So they are not can all of them get the mass close to the spring scale?
Yes, I will discuss this in this explicit example later. Is it okay? Let's postpone this question.
But when you say exotic, you're including vector-like pairs of matter.
Yeah.
Exotic.
They contribute to running ORGs if they are not having.
Can we discuss? Can we postpone this discussion? I fully agree. If they are light, the potential is spoil gauge coupling unification. Okay, these models have automatically the feature that there's a seesaw. Seesaw means, and we can really understand what seesaw means. We have simply couplings between Higgs fields and leptons to right-handed neutrino, where right-handed neutrino is defined as a matter parity odd standard model singlet. And if you look at the couplings of these fields, and if you find, and we find that these right-handed neutrinos get heavy once we switch on certain vacuum expectation values, then you get the standard seesaw. The only difference to the seesaw, as it is discussed in the phenomenological literature, is that the number of right-handed neutrinos is not 3, but it's 49 or something like that. It's order 100. This is actually a good feature because it, in a certain way, raises the scale of this effective neutrino mass operator a little bit against the naive gut prediction, which would give you a little bit too low result in order to explain the atmospheric neutrino oscillations. So this might...
Weinberg operator, is that the Weinberg operator?
Yeah, this is the effective Weinberg operator. This is nothing but the good old effective Weinberg operator. And this doesn't care if there are 3 or 100 right-handed neutrinos exchanged.
But then you need a very small... It's issue of scale, right?
What was the issue of scale?
The way this Weinberg operator is suppressed, it has to be lower scale. Right, effective scale in the denominator of one operator.
There are two. If you have 3 right-handed neutrinos and the gut scale, you have a hard time explaining atmospheric neutrino oscillations. If you have instead 100 neutrino, then in a sense you have more contributions to this Weinberg operator, right? And this, in a certain way, increases the effective neutrino mass a little bit. Yeah? And actually, this factor 10 to 100 is precisely what you need. I'm not claiming that this is the mechanism in the world, but it's an interesting observation.
So you want many right-handed neutrinos
for one. Yeah, because then you get a little bit enhanced CISO, effective CISO scale, lower CISO scale. Okay, then the gauge coupling is predicted to more or less unify with the top U cover coupling, or the other way around, which is also known to be good. I mean, both of them are order 1. Actually, it turns out, if you look at the details, it turns out that the gauge top U cover coupling is slightly suppressed against the gauge coupling, which is consistent with standard MSSM running. And all other U covers turn out to be suppressed, so they only appear if you give certain singlet fields vacuum expectation values. There are potential solutions to mu, Susi flavor, and proton decay problems, which I discuss later. And
I ask you about this issue because that's something, right, that is rather core to have even a chance to get any reasonable flavor structure, right? What prevents you from getting other linear couplings for the
other matter. Other than what?
Than top.
Why are the other
couplings? The thing is, the top to cover coupling comes from the gauge interaction. So you have a higher dimensional gauge theory, and only certain fields which appear as massless modes really come from the gauge multiplet, from the adjoint of E8, and other fields come from the twisted sectors. And these twisted states do not really have gauge interactions with the Higgs fields, which also come from extra components of the gauge boson. So the only extra components of the gauge bosons are the ingredient of the top U cover coupling plus the Higgs fields. And this happens in a certain way by accident.
So you're saying you're engineering your orbital constructions that one family comes from one twisted sector?
And no. The funny thing is that, no. We did not. We first tried to get models where we had, for instance, three localized families. But all these models turned out to have chiral exotics, be very bad, and so on. And then we went on to models where we have two localized families, and the third family appears as an accident. And all of a sudden, we did obtain models with the chiral spectrum of the MSSM, and then this turned out to be so. We didn't really search for that.
You localized two families on orbital points, and then third one is somewhat delocalized. I guess that's the reason.
Yeah, but we did not. I mean, we did not impose it when we searched for the models. Yeah, it is true. I mean, in the end, it is such that the model is constructed in such a way that two families are localized, while the third one is not. But this is something which we did not put in by impose. Yeah? We first did something which is extremely stupid. We searched for models with three sequential families where all families are localized. And it turns out that all these models have chiral exotics. We could even prove that.
So that was your landscape search.
Like one family localized or 17? I mean, three is engineered.
Right? Yeah, sure. You can have models with more than three families. You can have also models with just one localized family, but the number of these models compared to the overall number of models is very low. So the fraction of good models within this construction is very small, whereas here 1% of, if you start with two localized families, then you have 1% of all possible models is the MSSM.
So it was your landscape analysis,
yeah, yeah.
Right? And that's the output of good things that...
Yeah, precisely.
I mean, maybe one can make it a little more precise what is input and output, yeah, because that is, I think, an interesting point. Originally, the starting point was to construct something which has, say, at least one localized family. That means to have an orbital construction where you have a fixed point with an unbroken group containing SO10 and a localized 6-week plate. That was the starting point. And in addition, you wanted to break to the standard model. And then there was a big scan performed, and it turned out that the maximum which one could find in scanning all these possibilities were in fact two localized families. Mm-hmm. There's no example, I think, with 17 or so, if you also want to break to the standard model. So you can have only two. And it turned out, funny enough, that there was that there were additional split multiplets coming from the bulk, which combined the two third families. A third family in the sense that they have standard model quantum numbers of the third family, but it would not be a third family in the sense of an SU5 SO10 representation. And it's a strange thing. I don't know, maybe one can find, a smart person can find the reason behind that, mm-hmm. But I think it's a strange thing that so far no model has been found with more than two localized families. I mean, I don't know. Why is this so?
Well, I mean, in just more generic collabias, you'll find localized families all over the place, right, from the cohomology. But you're restricting to certain orbital points?
Yes. I mean, this is probably a consequence of the geometries.
So this is a statement true for orbitals. Mm-hmm. And I think the first class where this works at all are the Z6 orbitals. But I know even some examples. I think Kim and company constructed Z12. And there we have the same phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So it could be that this is true for, in fact, for all orbital constructions, if you also want to break the standard model.
Yeah, but I think that yeah, you may have other schemes where you have simply more localized families. Yeah. But not here.
There has been now such research for a while, and I'm not aware of any example.
Yeah.
Well, Calabi-Yau's, you don't have localized families. Here they are localized on orbifold points. That's what you mean in internal space.
They're not completely localized, but they're associated with certain cohomology classes, right, which are associated with certain cycles in the metaphor.
Right.
Well,
it's really back to Bandos or Calabi-Yau, right? So it's hard to think about localization.
Well, it's a question of where these
come on. I mean, I'm talking about where they sit as wave functions, right, in internal space.
Right.
Here in orbifold, it's very clear. You know, when it's stuck on fixed point, that's conformal theory tells you those are twisted states, right? And physically, they're stuck there.
For example, in spectral cover, mm-hmm. vacuum bundles, the mass of matter is also localized on the matter curves on the base, say, of the elliptic vibration. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, I'm just saying the homology classes are sort of separated in various different locations, and it seems clear geometrically you can proliferate families if you want.
Okay. And what these models also have is, of course, a lot of standard model singlets, which might be charged in the second EA and whatever. And I will now briefly discuss these fields.
For instance, they can be charged under the second EA?
Yeah, most of them are. I mean, we have, of course, the geometrical moduli, T and S, and maybe complex structure moduli. But then we have a bunch of other fields, standard model singlets, which are charged under second EA and so on. Of course, you can. Yeah.
Can they ruin the asymptotic freedom of the second E8 if so many of these things around?
Well, first of all, the second E8 is broken. Also, we have no model where we can keep this unbroken. And actually, it turns out that the subgroup, the unbroken subgroup of the second E8, is always something like SU4, SU5, something. Yeah, which is has a nice condensation scale.
But not if it has all these singles attached to it, right? I mean, yes, by itself could have a nice condensation scale, but you're going to have all these charges.
Yeah, but okay, the main thing is that once you give refs to certain fields, many of these extra charge states just decouple, get large masses. I mean, that's what we checked. I mean, first of all, it turns out that in most of these models, these extra states, stage charge under the subgroup of the second EA are vector-like, and second, we have to switch on certain refs, for instance, to cancel the FI term and the Fayolopoulos term and get rid of extra U1 factors, which we don't like. And once we do so, this extra, this additional matter gets typically massive. We have now 200 models. I cannot say that there's no exception to this statement, but in all examples which I have looked at, it is such, as I told you.
You have only one anomalous U1 is
yes.
Universal.
Yes.
U1 with Fayolopoulos
yes.
One loop generated.
Yes. These are a billion orbifolds, just one. Okay, now we have looked, for instance, at one model which we call heterotic benchmark model 1A because it's matter parity and all these features is an explicit example. And there we need to switch on 23 standard model singlets in order to cancel the FI term and get rid of the unwanted U1 factors. Here in this setting, we have checked that explicit asymmetry breaking terms appear at order 9 in superpotential. So, and actually, we did not, I didn't know this proof of this U1R. When we did this analysis, what we always found after solving the F-term equations, that the superpotential vanishes, and we didn't understand, but the reason behind this is an approximate U1R symmetry. And what we solved is F and T flatness, and then we search for solutions where all these singlet refs are not larger than 1, smaller than 1 in Planck units. And we argue that they exist, and argue means that there's a loophole. We do, at the present, we do not really understand the coupling coefficients of higher order couplings extremely well. So we can just argue that there are good reasons that these things exist. And I believe that this is the case, but I have no proof as we are just not working with these higher order couplings.
You do have your conformal field theory techniques
yes.
to see if term of certain type is allowed.
Sure, sure, sure.
Still be zero.
This we all take into account, sure. But then these couplings have certain coupling strengths, right? Which are in principle also calculable, but I have not seen any closed expression for order 9 couplings on orbifolds. So, and you're working on this. Okay, and then once we look,
you're using the rigid supersymmetry constraints or the globe or the local.
It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter because in this regime, the superpotential Markov expectation value is always suppressed, as I explained before, and it is just a very small shift. It really doesn't matter. You can solve either.
So you don't need the Kähler potential at any place here.
Because the superpotential Markov expectation value at these points, which I'm looking at, is very small.
So sorry, are you saying here that you're stabilizing some of the moduli?
Yeah, yeah. The thing is, we're now looking at these non-trivial field configurations, and it turns out that all of these singlets are tiny Markov expectation values. Masses get massive.
Can you say again what the superpotential was? That you
the superpotential is just we do an. We calculate the couplings allowed couplings, write down all allowed couplings up to order 9 in these singlet fields. And we just use the standard orbifold selection rules.
So you calculate those things and you find these minima?
Excuse me?
You calculate those things and you find these minima explicitly?
No. No, we don't calculate the coupling coefficients.
You can affect the field theory expansion.
Yeah, but we don't know what the coupling strengths are explicitly. We have just some naive guess and then it works. But this is the loophole.
So maybe this is okay. I think the assumption is that once a coupling is allowed by selection rule, then it has a coefficient of 1.
Not necessarily all the 1, we know that some of them are suppressed, yeah, because... I mean,
of course, that's specific potential is not known. And that is that's a significant problem, and some words on that is going to be like this.
We know that some of them are suppressed because they are non-local couplings, they work from worksheet instanton and so on, this we all know, but we don't really know the precise coefficient. Okay.
Do you know when you classify D-flat directions, right, and a couple with F terms, there are a lot of directions.
No.
Huge number of those SIs.
Right? No, this is simply not the case. It's known that the orbits of F and D flatness or equals 0 intersect in one point generically. So,
you need F flatness for the full covariant derivative.
Yeah, but this doesn't really matter. No, but see, this we can also study numerically or explicitly. The first approximation is to just take a global SUSY F terms and then this small superpotential vacuum expectation value does not match. We have really checked that because it's small. Yeah, but the Keller potential is at most order one. It's not, see, we get now a superpotential vacuum expectation value, which was like order S to the 9. So if S is order 0.1, 0.3, and so on, this is pretty much suppressed. And we have checked that if you do the same, this it's really supergravity, it doesn't matter. Because simply the superpotential vacuum expectation value is small. If it wasn't small, of course, then you get huge corrections.
So you're saying that in these kind of constructions you can't get ADL, can't get anti de Sitter vacuum?
No, sure. At that level it's anti de Sitter, right? Because now you solve the F-term equations.
It's far too large anti de Sitter, no matter what you're saying here.
Okay, this is just one example where we have 23 fields switched on. And the general picture is that if we switch on less fields, then we got high orders at which explicit supersymmetry, asymmetry breaking terms are there. Like we have another model where we switch on 7 fields, and then this order is 26. And I have not looked at all possible vacuum of all possible models, but what we do get is number order 10 at which explicit asymmetry breaking appears. Yeah?
Let's say that works, okay? But you're using this VEVs of those singlets to give mass to all your vector pairs, right? So those are all non-denominalizable terms.
Yeah.
If you have like sixth order term, then you're getting masses of these vector pairs that are 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude below string scale.
Yes. But let me discuss it later in an example. So yeah, but
you cannot have it both ways easily. You know?
I disagree, and I will show you later. Okay, so that's what we got, and the main statement is that here we get simply order 10 for this explicit asymmetry breaking. It really depends on how many fields you switch on and so on. Then to your question of this approximate Goldstone mode, it turns out that there is one, of course, because if this asymmetry was exact, there would be an exact Goldstone mode, but the mass of this field is goes like superpotential divided by typical VEF squared. So it's slightly heavier. If the typical VEF is below 1, it's slightly heavier than the vacuum expectation value of the
cosmological constant, TeV.
cosmological concept at that level.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is getting the CC.
No, I'm not trying that you're solving, I'm just asking.
At this level, it is a really bad anti-de-Sitter vacuum. Yeah, I have just shown you that I get a hierarchically small constant of the vacuum expectation value of the perturbative superpotential, nothing else. This is anti-de-Sitter vacuum, we do not live in such a world. I agree. But I get it very much suppressed. Superpotential vacuum expectation value, and it turns out there's one rather light mode, and the other modes are typically much heavier.
So in order to get gauge genome masses, you eventually have to break this symmetry, is that right?
In order to get gauge genome masses.
You have this R symmetry, is it?
Yeah. I mean, this is, first of all, here it's explicitly broken, and I did not.
Very weakly. So, but I guess I'm asking what.
Can I discuss this in a second? I mean, this is of course an important question, but the gauge genome masses as usual will come from F-term, from the Dirac term, which is not yet included in the setting.
Okay, but it is limited by how? It is constrained by the symmetry.
Now, well, the question which you're really asking is, who corrects this vacuum energy? Who gets the F-term such that we have in the end cosmological constant zero? And if this is the Dilaton, for instance, you get gauge genome masses.
No, but the question was, what breaks the symmetry? So there's the gauge genome combination behind that with the gauge genome combination. So
maybe.
Is that the question?
No, the question is, if you left this unbroken, you're not get gauge genome masses.
I think this is. Let me discuss this in a second. So what I really want to briefly discuss now is what the applications of for this discussion is for the emesis mu term and modular stabilization. Let me start with a simpler thing. It turns out actually by Miriam and Hoffman and so on that the Keller potential for the Higgs fields which we have in this orbifold is well known. So this is the Keller potential. So these are certainly extra components with respect to a C2 orbifold plane. And this structure here is indeed enforced by higher dimensional gauge invariants. So first of all, if you engineer a situation where the T modulus acquires an F-term left, you get a mu term, just like in the Giudice-Masiero mechanism. However, what you also obtain is holomorphic contribution to the mu term, which is precisely the vacuum expectation value of the superpotential. So you can simply expand this Keller potential, and once you do so, you find that there is this holomorphic combination of these canonically normalized fields, and if you then calculate some effective superpotential, you find that this gets multiplied with the vacuum expectation value of the superpotential, of the perturbative superpotential, and you get a holomorphic contribution to the mu term, which has not been discussed too much in the literature. And actually, this is enforced by higher dimensional gauge invariants, which gives you the structure of the superpotential. And now, if you have a very much suppressed W, which sets the scale for the gravitino mass in the end, you get a suppressed mu term of the right order.
I'm a little bit confused. I thought matter field, the way they enter Keller potential is always field and its conjugate. Here you seem to have some holomorphic parts there.
Yes, but I refer to your paper.
No, but we didn't do that part. We did the first part.
This is also written.
This is a better. I mean, there was some subsequent, but I think.
No. This is well known. This Keller potential is well known from field and string theory. Higher dimensional gauge invariants. There's some SU6 gauge invariants. I'm sure about this. I mean, also these gentlemen calculated this Keller potential. Okay. And now, of course, you can dream of addressing really fundamental questions like fixing the dilaton. So what I explained so far is that we can have a very small vacuum expectation value of the superpotential. Now, if we add non-perturbative corrections, contributions to the superpotential like gauge genome condensation, blah, 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 you have an effective superpotential which looks like this, and this is really pretty much the AKT superpotential, apart from the fact that there is an approximate R axon which is heavier than the gravitino. And now, if you really
we now argue that simply since the superpotential is suppressed in some orbifold vacuum, it might simply the perturbative superpotential at time very much suppress vacuum expectation value. And it is well known that if you just write this down, minimize it, you fix the dilaton.
What's gonna condense to give you this?
A hidden sector, subgroup of section V8, for instance. There are all sorts of non-perturbative superpotential terms which people here know much better than I do.
But even for SU5, I mean, what is the size of the gauge group in standard like SU5?
It's SU5, SO8, something like this. So typically there's a nice peak.
So I don't remember the bound, but if you transmit that via gravity, is that big enough?
Yeah.
At SU4?
Yeah. And you have to.
There's a sort of a limiter around SU4, SU5, where it just gets too small.
Yeah, we had looked at these 200 models and calculated the naive scale of Gacino condensation. Yeah, by just saying that you're just running down and see that this coupling explodes. And it turns out that if you do the naive estimate, like M3/2 is lambda cubed over M Planck squared, plug it in, then you find that there's a nice peak in these models at TV. Yeah, there's a nice correlation. We have 200 models, we have calculated this lambda, and then it turns out that soft masses, according to this very naive estimate, are peaked at TV.
And all these light particles which carry this extra hidden E8 index are heavy enough to show that they are?
Well, we see that they appear at order something in this singlets, and if this order is 2 or 3, then they are a bit below the Planck scale. Who cares? I mean, and this is a naive estimate. The most critical thing are, in effect, the string thresholds. So they shift the prediction for the gauge coupling of the second E8. This is the most critical, strongest influence. It shifts this around, and then there are these vector-like states and blah, blah, blah. Everything is there. And this is a naive estimate. Okay. And these effects actually go in opposite directions. So.
Are you using your symmetry to kill the W0 term?
Excuse me?
Are you using a symmetry to make the first statement there that the perturbative is...
Yeah, this was the main point, that if you have an approximate R-symmetry, then this is approximately zero. It's very
much
so
you're using, this is the same symmetry you have to get the 10 to the minus 10.
Yeah. So because, yes.
So what, that's a Z what symmetry?
Well, in this class of models, we have a C6 times C3 times C2 asymmetry. Coming from the three different orbifold planes which have discrete rotational symmetries.
Can the F terms adjust against your small W, small F, small W?
Yeah, so this is of course not the hope, yeah?
Yeah.
And now you should ask Stuart when he comes next week. He claims you can. I don't know.
Who claims?
Stuart Wadi. So this is now just the paper by Stuart, and they wrote down some toy example, yeah? And what they find is that all these fields get stabilized, so S and T, they have just one universal Kähler modulus and so on, but they have started with a toy example and found at least arguments that you can stabilize all fields and you can use this very much suppressed superpotential vacuum expectation.
Did they include a complex structure,
No, this is really a toy example, it's just one universal Kähler modulus.
The only reason I say that is that the complex structure are normally really the killer in this. I mean, the complex structure are normally really the killer if you try to do a KKL type T type thing in heterotic.
Yeah, so you should tell this to it.
Yeah, I'll bet. Keep thinking about it, so maybe
I mean, this is it's really just exploring these things. I'm not saying that this is the final answer, but they came up with toy examples where they claim that they find vacua in which this vacuum energy is almost zero, the cosmological negative cosmological constant is almost cancelled up to 3% or something like this. S is stabilized like in KKLT, T is stabilized by T duality invariance and blah blah blah. And they say that all these fields which you put in have non-zero masses.
So do they tune those A, B parameters to
no.
that? Well, that must be some parameterization by this.
No, the only thing is that they assume that this W is not as extremely suppressed because of approximate asymmetry. The other things are not tuned as far as I can tell.
Why are phi 1 and phi 2 still present in the potential there and not taken into account in W naught? Why are some of the fields present?
Please ask the steward. I really don't know. I mean, for me, I just copied this formula from his paper. For me, it seems very complicated, but at least he tried to, you see, address this question. And this is certainly just a toy example. Usually you have much more fields, and it seems to become much more technically challenging. And why he put this field and not that field, and why he put some exponent here like this, I don't know. One thing which I can tell you is that some of these fields are needed in order to cancel the FI term. So of course he cancels the FI locus term and switches on these fields and takes them into account. There's a FI locus term and he does it, and please ask him.
Are they taking these one loop determinants or one loop threshold corrections to the gauge gated functions here into account? That's what I'm confused about.
Yeah, in a sense they approximate in the large T limit, this is what they get here.
But this is treated as a constant. In general, it's modular dependent.
This is the modular dependency, this coefficient.
Well, this coefficient in front of this, if it was something in general, is a highly complicated function of some of the models.
Yes. But see, they just approximated by this one. You should criticize too. So that's why I put these names, yeah? I don't know. I mean, this might work, might or might not work.
Okay.
I think. Of course, I mean, this is a really tricky business with all these fields.
Sure.
And you have to go step by step. Okay.
Maybe to go to Eva's questions, how do the genus recognize?
Here in this setting, the dilaton acquires a suppressed but non-zero F-term map, and this gives you the genome masses. So it's a little bit like in KKT, this, the F-term is suppressed against the F-term of the T-field, which dominates by factor 10 or something like this. But they argue that this is sufficient in order to get good genome masses. So it's a little bit like this mirage pattern of soft masses. Mm-hmm. So scalars are heavier than genomes, but genomes can have nevertheless large enough masses.
Why again doesn't this spoil the fact W, why doesn't that spoil the fact that W0 was small?
Sorry?
Yeah, as Eva pointed out, if you use the R symmetry to have W0 small, but now
this is a perturbative vacuum expectation value of the perturbative superpotential.
Okay, non-perturbative.
And now they add all this non-perturbative stuff. But as I told you, I mean, this vacuum expectation value, there's only one light rod, this approximate R axiom, but it's still heavier than the gravitino. So you can have, in a certain way, an effective theory which gives you something like this. I mean, this is the only thing. I mean, of course, if there would be an extremely light mode, you always have to have it, and maybe it comes to the vacuum expectation value in the end, but this seems not to be the case. All right. Then, okay, one can also discuss other ways of discussing this complex structure, maybe even the Kaelin complex structure moduli, simply because we search for point-like solutions to the F and B equations, and actually the couplings are, of course, moduli dependent. And if we find such solutions, it might well be that also these fields get stabilized, because actually you have to take into account all of these fields. And this is something which we are now trying to really find, if this is really true, if we really calculate the coupling strength in these superpotentials and really take into account the Kähler and complex structure moduli dependence, which is in principle doable, then we can search for point-like solutions in the whole field space where all fields are stabilized. Whether or not these things exist, I don't know. This is work in progress, but we hope so. I mean, at least field theoretically, there seems to be no obstacle. Okay, so now let me come to phenological questions, and I think, I'm sorry, but I think it's much better to have discussion instead of much material. But let me now discuss other things.
We are just arguing, About these three factors, what kind of moduli dependence they have?
This one.
Yeah, because general, this is, this is string tree level, so there is no
dilaton. No, this is not dilaton. This is just the key in this complex structure modulus, and you have this worksheet in some coupling, right?
Yeah, but they are all Kähler moduli.
Yeah, this is the Kähler moduli.
So I was just wondering, I'm not...
You mean there's no C dependence?
No, how does it depend on complex structure?
Yes, I don't know. So you're the expert, I don't know. Maybe this doesn't, and then we have a problem. It could well be. I don't know. Okay, let me now come back to the...
Can I ask you another
issue? Sure.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's the issue, yeah.
Okay.
About the discrete symmetry.
Yeah, this is actually...
Is that a genuine discrete symmetry that you have in your theory, and do waves of those S break the discrete symmetry?
No, the waves of the S precisely do not break the symmetry, and then I would have no... The waves of the S fields break a continuous B minus L symmetry.
It's broken by any waves.
What? This metaparity.
Symmetry.
Not metaparity. Metaparity is unbroken.
Metaparity.
It's unbroken. We have a continuous B minus L symmetry and break it to a C2 subgroup. And this C2 subgroup is unbroken.
I'm talking about this discrete
arc. I mean, that's a question of the vacuum. I mean, you can have you have a number of fields which can acquire vacuum filtration values, and generically, and at this orbital point, you have a number of UI factors which are massless, and this large discrete symmetry which we can rule out. Now, in a particular vacuum, now you break to a subgroup. You can break it completely, but depending on which fields acquire that, a certain subgroup can remain, and that these remaining subgroups then contain interesting discrete subgroups, which, for instance, can forbid a new term or which restrict allowed couplings.
So this is actually the main point here, that we always have some remnant symmetries, which are left unbroken, approximate and remnant symmetries, which explain many features. So approximate R-symmetries explain suppressed superpotential. Now I come to the other symmetries.
So in fact, I mean, the fundamental thing is, of course, not an a continuous R-symmetry, but just a discrete R-symmetry. And then a remnant of that in a particular vacuum, and the fields which in principle can acquire depth are such that, you know, some terms can appear only at very high powers of fields. And that gives you this more to analyze.
I hear you on that, and I appreciate all that. What I'm after is, there is a field theory statement that if you spontaneously break discrete symmetry, you may have cosmological problems.
I mean, that is if you have a cosmological phase transition, but here we are talking not about cosmological phase transition.
Well, no, people do worry, you know, left-right symmetric models, domain walls.
But that is only a problem if you break this discrete symmetry in a cosmological phase transition. I think here we are looking for.
To do
cosmology
physics,
with this 300, with this 50 scale is of course completely hopeless. Yeah, right? The question is whether you
it's a particle physics that you're focusing on. I'm hearing you, but this is if that's embedded.
But when you discuss it, I don't see the answer.
Depends on the scale.
Yeah.
If it's a low enough scale, you're bound to have a phase.
Yeah, but the scale is at 10 TeV or something, or 1 TeV.
No, these objects are very heavy.
Yeah, except for this approximate R symmetries, everything gets very heavy.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I have another question along these lines. I mean, in order to break down to some kind of discrete symmetries from any kind of U1, whatever, you need certain kinds of multiplets, right, that
right.
carry the. You know, if it's B minus L, then you have to have the right, you know, even number of B minus L. These things occur primordially in your spectrum when you...
Yes, they
do.
And
you're expecting them, what, to get large?
I mean, large waves, yeah.
You can't treat them as heavy and integrate them out and treat them as light as an effective field theory to get them entirely, can you? You have to have them at some intermediate scale or something like that, don't you?
I mean, you can't really... Of course, the trouble is you don't know precisely what these waves are. You cannot calculate. For that, you would have to know precisely this population, which is not the case. But generically, as Michael said, I mean, you have these SI, which are, say, of order 0.1. So if you have that,
then that allows you to see which fields you can decouple. And at the same time, once you do the decoupling, what is the remaining discrete symmetry?
But what kind of devs do you expect to give these things? I'm just wondering if there seems to be a level, you know, few orders of magnitude below it. A compactification scale, whatever scale you want to use, a string scale.
It's
for extra things which have these extra symmetries, which you then give a VEV, but that VEV is not your high scale. It's got to be some kind of intermediate scale, any sense.
Okay, one of the VEVs is set by this Feyeloopoulos transition, which is a bit 0.3 times Planck scale or something like this. So this is something which sets some VEV scales, right?
Yeah, well, we can discuss a little bit. I'm always concerned when, in a certain sense, you could integrate these out to begin with. They're not in your spectrum at all, and then you get all this physics from it. How does that happen? That's what I always ask myself. But somehow it does.
Okay. Yeah, the thing is, I mean, of course, they are not tremendously suppressed. So you can ask if this expansion in these web fields makes sense or not. And we hope that it does. I mean, this is the best that we can do.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
But if it's 0.3 or so, okay, we can expand this. I mean, people in QCD expand even in larger things. But, you know, I mean, of course, this can be criticized. Okay, so we have this fields which have even B minus L charge, and the crucial, this is only possible if, of course, this B minus L is not just a subgroup of SO10, but mixes with something else which it does here. And if we give certain refs to fields which have even over odd B minus L charge, we have also just matter parity. Okay, now we not discuss all these technical details. Actually, to really find out if you start with a large continuous and discrete set of continuous and discrete symmetries and give certain refs, what is really the remnant symmetry is technically a bit non-trivial. Maybe somebody has done it before, I don't know. At least we have done that. And we have, we put these things on a certain charge lattice and so on, diagonalize and so on, and in the end, we get a very simple answer. So we have, do not discuss this here in detail because we have a computer code which does it for us. If you ever have a situation, we have large symmetries broken by many VEVs to something, and want to know what this something is, this can be done, and there's a computer code. Yeah, you can do that. And now I will just briefly discuss applications, namely matter parity and forbidding the emissions and neuter. And the example which I'm looking at is now not from the mini landscape because I gave mini landscape talks now for 4 years or so. So I'm now doing something new. And the something new is not a C6 orbifold, but a C2 cross C2 orbifold. And the way we construct this orbifold is we construct an orbifold which has 6 generations of SU5, but this orbifold has a freely acting C2 symmetry which can be modded out and which can be used first of all in order to reduce the number of generations to 3, and second of all we can put a Wilson line to this operation in such a way that SU5 gets broken to the standard model. And this is, of course, very similar to what you did with your C3, cos C3, or Donaghi and Bouchard did with the SU5 model. So this is also possible in orbifolds. And if you do that, people think that, Dutch models, in a sense, have more consistent with precision gauge coupling unification because thresholds are, to a large extent, avoided. Second, such models in principle can be completely blown up. So every orbifold singularity can in principle be completely blown up without destroying hypercharge. So there's no localized flux in hypercharge directions at the fixed points. So some people like to do that. I don't know if it's necessary, but maybe it is. Probably not. This 4D gauge group of this model, just to have one explicit example. This example is not well chosen because we have just an SU3 hidden sector, but we have many other examples. Anyway, so it has a standard model, gauge group times some E minus L group times something which we destroy by giving refs to singlet fields or let it condense. This is the massless spectrum at the orbifold point. We have 3 generations of quarks and leptons. Plus, we have singlets, plus We have exotics with quantum numbers of down-type quarks and lepton duplets, but with strange Beamer-Zell charge. So these are these fields, and then we have certain representations under this hidden group. For instance, we have a five-vector-like pairs of triplets under this hidden SU3. Okay, so this spectrum is three generations per vector-like. And this B-L symmetry, which we found, which is one possible choice out of many, allows us to distinguish between matter and Higgs fields or exotics. So these H fields are Higgs candidates or exotics. And okay, as I discussed, the singlets have, there are certain singlets which have zero or even a B-L charge. And as long as we switch on these fields, we have a matter parity, discrete C2 subgroup of U1 B minus L. And okay, this model has certain good features. For instance, these exotics all decouple at the linear level in this web field. So this comes, you know, back to the theorem's question. Yeah? So everything is linear in this, all exotics decouple at the linear level. So there's no hierarchy. Yeah? Then we have non-trivial Yukawa couplings induced by these singlet webs. Again, as before, gauge coupling and top Yukawa coupling unify. And okay, this model has an interesting or curious feature which comes from this Wilson line breaking, namely there are five relations for the down type and lepton Yukawas, which are in a sense disciple for the heavy generation, but not so good for the first two generations. And what is bad about this model, about which we discussed so far, about this vacuum which I discussed so far, is of course that the Higgs fields, all of these H's decouple at the linear level, so we have no Higgs pair. And this situation, as I understand, is very, is comparable to the situation in Calabi-Yau vacua, where also the new term is of order of the Planck scale.
But not always. Let me just point out yesterday that, that in fact, some of these vacua have generic one Higgs,
okay,
and they do not have a linear coupling. They do not get heavy. Only some of them are.
Is there a symmetry which explains it?
It doesn't require a symmetry.
Really?
It's just the bundle. That just generically for bundles, the cohomology is for a single HH bar pair. Period. The problem is more when you have a higher codimension surface and you show that generically for moduli you get zero HH bar pairs, and then on a higher codimension surface you find that then, because it's, you know, it's singular, if you like, you can get a pair to grow, but then when you move up off of it you get the pair. So it's not so, there are good models in,
okay,
that don't have that problem at all.
But I'm giving now this talk because we are able to identify symmetries which explain. But
no, you shouldn't think that I'm missing something if I say.
No, I'm not saying that you're missing, but here,
simply it's not.
So, because I'm stupid field theorist, so I want to see a symmetry which solves this problem, and I have one. Okay.
Right, but I'm a stupid algebraic geometry, and let me just say it doesn't enter. When you're doing these smooth bundles, it's simply a matter of what their smooth cohomology is. And if you look for singular points where it jumps, that's special points. So what you tend to do is look, if you want symmetry, look for the most general non-special points, and there are examples that are non-special and have perfectly no mu problem in HH bond.
I see.
Okay. I should comment on that. It doesn't really jump, it's a continuous process because it couples to vector bundle module.
Well, that's what his is too. He's got a linear
component. So there is a flat direction sort of when you're moving the module as fast on vector bundles. So it jumps as a function, it continuously changes as a function of that, of certain vector bundle modulus.
But that's sort of
which is NMSSM type mechanism for new parameter.
Once you explain why the singlet attains a ref of the TV scale, which is probably hard to do.
Right, you'd have to show that you'd have to
say. Well, there.
Okay. So the point here is that there are many, many, many equivalent ref configurations which you can think of with various different discrete symmetries. And it turns out that one can solve, okay, there's also potentially proton decay problem, and it turns out that simple C2R symmetry allows us to solve both problems simultaneously.
Could I maybe just go back to this issue of Higgs's, because that reminds me of the Dibbrin picture too. Typically, if Higgs pairs happen to come from genuinely chiral intersections, new parameter is strictly zero. right? So that's an analog of when it's genuinely from Karolin origin, they can never tear up. And you see that geometrically when this appears, that says H up and H down come from genuinely Karolin intersections. So they are genuinely, they are not vector pairs geometrically. Mm-hmm. They just happen to have opposite quantum numbers. So there's one way of getting them. In this case, mu parameter is always zero. But when they come from effective n equal 2 sector and they are just effectively coming from n equal 2 pair, then you can continuously deform them and give them mass as you know, move in one. Well, anyway, there are ways of viewing Higgs's as coming as generally n equal 1 chiral fields or something that has memory of n equal 2.
Okay, for me, Higgs is just meta parity even SU2 doubles is the right quantum number. So that's a Higgs.
No, I think there is, in this picture, there's something similar to what you said. I mean, if you have all these doublets and you ask who is a lepton and who is a Higgs, then, now that depends then on the vacuum which you have. And in this picture, it depends on the discrete symmetries which remain. And it turns out, if you take this picture where it is only for Gaff, picture which Michael showed that you have, say, 6D as an intermediate state. Then, if both the two Higgs's, H1 and H2, come from the untwisted set of bulk fields, in that case, then you have a problem with the mu term. The problem with the mu term, you can have vanishing mu term if one of the Higgs's comes from bulk field and the other from a twisted set.
Yeah, and
that's how
it works.
But actually, if you both are untwisted, you have all the distribution which I presented before. We have simply
from the analysis of these discrete apparatus, I think in that case you cannot forbid the mu term to all orders.
It's not forbidden, but then it turns out to be proportional to the vacuum expectation value of W.
No, that I agree. I mean, that connection you have always.
If it's from the untwisted sector,
then at higher orders, at some point you will generate a new term.
Yeah, but it is proportional, you can show using
higher mitigation.
Yeah,
the value of W is usually, it's not guaranteed to be small.
Yeah, unless you have this approximate asymmetries and don't.
No, but I mean, the approximate asymmetries is only a consequence of the fundamental discrete symmetry.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, but I think the fact that the mu term disappears to all orders in this powers of single field, I think, requires that one of the Higgs's comes from the opposite sector, the other thing.
No, simply in the other picture.
I mean, we can.
Yeah, we can discuss, but I fully disagree. I mean,
why do you want exactly zero mu term?
So of course, you do not want. You want something that's small, from almost zero.
I mean, small effect. That will not be perfectly fine.
No, sure.
And that's
all. Yeah, a number of things how you make it.
Well, in this case, you don't have. Do you have an example that you can keep W very small?
Yeah, this is the example. We have a C2R. C2 means R means that under this operation, superpotential flips sign. Superfields transform with plus or minus. Actually, for the fermions, the C2R is a misnomer, so the fermions, for the fermions, is a C4 symmetry. Okay, this I will now skip because I have no time. And this is a vacuum configuration in this model with C2, meta parity times C2R. So this is just an example, this is the spectrum. We have quarks, leptons, and exotics. We can tell them apart by this meta parity, which survives. And we have a C2R symmetry. So first of all, we can distinguish between leptons and Higgs fields. And these are now the quantum numbers. Yeah? So these are the quarks and so on. And we have C2 meta, this is the first entry. C2R, this is the second entry. And now you can simply look which couplings exist or do not exist. So first of all, for instance, if you want to decouple this one pair of additional DD bar pairs or LL bar pairs, then we find that just looking at this table, that there, this is the structure of the mass matrix, if you wish. And here, these fields appear at order 9. However, the
this does not screw up gauge coupling unification because there are SU5 relations. So these masses coincide and there is a vector-like pair filling out a complete SU5 representation which might have an intermediate scale mass. But this is not so important. What is important is that the C2R and these other symmetries dictate the structure of the mass matrices. For instance, here, for these delta fields, these exotic fields, R part T even SU3 triplets with otherwise downtime quantum mandates. And what we find is that all these guys decouple at the linear level. Likewise, here, we find that two of them decouple at the linear level, whereas there's a row with zeros, which is enforced by the C2R symmetry. So as long as this C2R is there, there's one pair, one linear combination, one pair of massless Higgs fields. So it's this H1 bar and a linear combination of these. And these zeros are dictated by the C2R symmetry. So we have one pair of massless Higgs, and then we can discuss further Yukawa structures. So for instance, the up-type Yukawa coupling has this structure. We have gauge coupling for the first, for the third generation. Then we have certain zeros. Plus we have non-trivial couplings for the first and second generations. So this is the structure which we get. I'm not claiming that this is absolutely fully realistic, but this is a good approximation to what we see.
This theory have domain one problem.
Yeah?
V2R is frogged by Higgs pair.
By Higgs pair?
Yeah.
It is also, I will tell you this is also broken by non-perturbative effects in a second, but maybe we can discuss later. Okay, then we calculate the other couplings. We have also a structure similar to that. And okay, before integrating out this additional pair of leptons, we have this structure. So this is, and these zeros are against enforced by the C2R symmetry. Actually, the tau type and charged lepton Yukawa couplings are not so good. They have SU5 relations. And also the eigenvalues might be simply too small. So I'm not saying that this is a model of the world. It has certain good features, but maybe this is.
I just want to comment. I think that there should be requirement in any string phenomenology talk to spell out good problems and good things and equal number of bad things.
But it might not be
other bad things here, so we can work on and improve that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is just one vacuum in one out of many possible models, and me now looking at these models. Yeah, I'm not probably we don't write this vacuum really up. We write something else. Anyway, so now what is also important is that QQQL, once we have obtained the Yukawa couplings, we know who is heavy, who is light, and we find that the QQQL operators for the light generations are forbidden by the C2R symmetry. So we now know who is light quark doublet, and it turns out that these coefficients are zero for the light. The dangerous QQQL operators are zero. Not all of the QQQL operators are zero, but the dangerous ones.
How about your neutrino masses?
Neutrino masses are all there in this vacuum at the perturbative level, except for one which appears only after, which is forbidden by C2R. And now I will tell you that there's an anomaly. So this C2R is actually broken at the non-perturbative effect level.
You mean the Iraq masses are there?
Yeah, they are. Majorana masses are there. And we have, I don't know, I forgot, 31 between or something like this? I forgot. It's just matter parity odd standard model signal.
So you're saying you have natural C-sons?
Sure. In all these heterotic orbifold models which I ever looked at, we have CSO. Once we break, you see, we break this unwanted symmetries, we always get CSO. I mean, I never found a counterexample.
Maybe
you
have to write between the masses, qualitatively.
I mean, this is just a question of symmetries. If there's no symmetry left which forbids the Majorana mass term, then it will appear. And that's what we found explicitly by calculating the couplings or by checking that they consist with all string selections. I mean, this is the main thing, that if I break the symmetries far enough, then we can get I can let survive and break the symmetries. It's the whole game.
Yeah, you see, you want to get some small numbers out, right, by this. But then sometimes you want to keep some things at large scales too, right? So you're in this between the rock and what you call hard place, right? You want to get both things going, right? You want to get the scale, a lot of extra stuff to decouple that large enough scale. You want to keep cosmological constant, small mu, all of these small parameters, right, by the same mechanism.
Yeah. But this is simply the power of approximate symmetries. For instance, superpotential math appears only at very, very high orders in these singlets, whereas, for instance, the exotic masses appear at the linear level.
So you're
lucky.
No, I'm just trying to appreciate. Yeah.
I mean,
the one thing to get on certain points.
The approximate asymmetry is not luck. It's just approximate asymmetry. It's a symmetry.
It's qualitatively. How you get these small numbers, the mechanism is of course completely different. I mean, if you have the singlets, the heavy standard model singlets play effectively the role of right angle trios. So that means by the Yukawa couplings, you have heavy intermediate states, you integrate them out, and you generate dimension 5 operators with small coupling. That's roughly how the seesaw mechanism works. The thing with the mu term is completely different. There, the origin is the type of fields which in principle are available to acquire depths and the discrete symmetry from which you start. And that simply prevents that a small product gets above. You need something like 20 factors before you get a depth. So these are two, but it has mostly to do with these funny discrete symmetries.
Okay, so it turns out that this C2 is broken by non-perturbative effects, and we compute the non-perturbative couplings and see when they appear, and it turns out like nu is phi to the 11 times some e to the minus as with an approximate error. Then proton decay operators appear at the order 15, and the off-diagonal 1-3 entries in the up-tabular cover coupling, for instance, appear at order 4. So this is just an example. Again, probably this is too small to really account for 1-3 mixing in the quark sector. But what it really illustrates is that such an approximate symmetry might explain many problems at the same time.
You need some confined hidden sector, you can show us one.
Yeah, and in this example it's just an SU3, it's probably not okay, but this is what's just the first example we came up with. So I fully agree with you that this is, because we have always 100 models, so we can now dial this model and so on. Yeah. But what is kind of curious is that this anomalous C2R symmetry can in a certain way address, can be used in order to address many questions simultaneously. And it just happens to occur in this model. And there are many similar configurations. Okay, last point very briefly. There's a common structure to the to these models. So these are the mini landscape models. We have two localized families and one family from the bulk. And the same structure happens to be the case in the, or occur in this C2 model. And as a consequence of this geometry, there is a D4 non-abelian flavor symmetry in these models. So we have a D4 non-abelian flavor symmetry under which the two light generations transform as a doublet. As a consequence, the structure of soft mass terms is this plus terms which break the D4 symmetry. Yeah, so, and actually it turns out that the same vacuum expectation value of singlets which break the D4 symmetry are of course those who give you the Yukawa couplings. So what that means is that in the end we get a structure of soft terms where we have essentially this plus WEFs which give you the Yukawa couplings, and in the phenomenology this is known as minimal flavor violation ansatz. So the essentially, the structure of soft masses is unit matrix plus something which goes like y dagger y. And if you look at this and impose such things at the gut scale, the answer is, it turns out that
actually all these extra terms here, this beta coefficient is completely irrelevant. There are quasi fixed points which drive this beta coefficient to zero, and you always get universal predictions for the structure of soft masses. Okay, and this happens to be the same as in M Sucro. Okay, and this is something I just wanted to mention. It turns out that this Suzy flavor problem gets really ameliorated or even solved just because of some non-abelian discrete flavor symmetry, even in the presence of gravity mediation. Okay, summary.
Do you have a concrete mechanism of Suzy breaking and stabilization?
Yeah, it can.
Yeah, so what can you make this?
This doesn't depend on. I mean, the symmetry is always there. This is just a symmetry argument. I mean, whoever breaks supersymmetry, this will always be. Okay. So the first point which I want to re-emphasize is that one can, with an approximate R-symmetry, explain very much suppressed. With an approximate R-symmetry, you can explain a very much suppressed vacuum expectation value of a superpotential. This can play an important role in moduli fixing and also provide us with a solution to the new problem. Fourth point which I want to make, we have many models with exact MSSM models with an exact matter parity. And then I have shown you that you can also have some further symmetries which can provide an understanding by a new term is small and by proton decay suppressed. So this is just an example, and probably there are other symmetries and so on. It's at least worthwhile to explore these things. And the last point which I want to make is that there's a D4 symmetry which might help us to understand why soft Suzy, the structure of soft Suzy breaking mass terms is not dangerous. Thank you very much, and sorry for stealing your time.
With regard to vector-like pairs, and you're giving those to these moduli and making the vector-like pairs massive, in the semi-vector-like context, it's frequently possible when you start with one of these field theories and you make your vector-like pairs massive to figure out which geometric configuration you're going to, i.e. which bundle and smooth Calabi-I you could have written down that would never have had that spectra in the first place. Is there any intuition in the kinds of things you do that similarly you know what orbifold or blown-up orbifold you're heading towards?
Yes. This is now what people look at. They look at blowing up these orbifold singularities, and it's known that if you give a certain field, which is a twisted field, vacuum expectation value, this corresponds to blowing these things up. And there is this group called Nibbling et al. Who really specifically look at this model. And we actually constructed this model with Wilson line breaking in order to have a potential model where you can resolve all orbifold singularities.
So would that be necessary?
No, it's not absolutely not necessary. But if you have a model where you break the gut group at a fixed point, you can never blow up this fixed point completely because you then destroy some of the standard model. Yeah. But here, this is Wilson line breaking. The main reason why we looked at this or we constructed this model was that we have a model where we, in principle, can match or compare with these Calabi-I structures. But this is work in progress. I mean, this is, of course, tough, and you find that one particular orbifold admits of the order of thousands Calabi-I manifolds that you can go to here and there and so on. And, yeah.
Mechanisms for supersymmetry breaking again, you have the Geno condensation, which could do this.
Gino condensation by itself does not break Suzy, right? I mean.
Well, it depends. Yeah, depends on where the vacuum lies. But how are you going to break supersymmetry?
Yeah, this is of course a tough question. But we do have these nice hidden gauge factors, and now you can entertain possibilities like ISS setting, you know, Intrilegato-Seilweg-Xi. Like Intrilegato-Seilweg-Xi, this metastable vacuum, Suzy is broken. Yeah, this is one possibility.
which you can entertain. And probably there are other possibilities out there. I mean, I really don't know how sushi is frozen, but at least all the common ingredients which are usually there in the discussion of such questions are there in these models. So I don't see why this should be impossible. But this is a tough question, of course. Maybe the simplest thing is to assume that this condensing, whatever, SU4, SU5, has some ISS type SUSY breaking vacuum configuration. Or look for that. It's just a possibility, yeah? I mean,
no, that's okay. I understand.
But I'm not saying that this is the only possibility.
Could I ask Laura's question? I think Laura's question in some different way. I brought it up before. I was confused by this. I don't have any problem with it. I'm just trying to understand it. If I look at smooth stuff, I look at the zero moles with respect to some smooth vacuum. And then I can imagine after I break supersymmetry and whatever, lifting some of these up to some intermediate value.
Mm-hmm.
But they were originally zero modes of some vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
If I lift them so high that they essentially disappear from the,
sure,
the spectrum, then in a certain sense, that's not allowed, because you're really talking about a different vacuum that didn't have those as a zero mode.
Yeah,
and so in this process, you're lifting a lot of stuff up, you're saying very close to within an order of magnitude or so of whatever the mass scale is, mm-hmm, the mass. Is that consistent? You understand the consistency of that as it makes sense? I'm not saying it doesn't, I'm just asking.
I thought it was the good old knowledge from the Justice C3 orbifold. In the C3 orbifold, of course, you know, you have additional gauge factors. In the standard embedding Calabi-Yau, you have an E6 times E8, right? And no additional gauge factors and just certain 27 plates. On the other hand, there is a C3 orbifold where you have additional gauge factors like SU2, SU1, or SU3, or whatever you like.
SU3, actually.
It depends. If it's a C3 orbifold, it's like that. If it's a C4 orbifold, it's SU2, SU1, whatever. Yeah. And you have certain additional vector-like states, which, and then my understanding is that the matching, or you can go to the standard Calabi-Yau by giving just the blow-up field waves. And you check that this is consistent with steel flatness and so on. And nobody ever complained about this smooth transition.
I think it's a reminder of Dixon. We did that in 85, right? Just in proceedings, it's published actually the way Leonard Mills lived in a specific way. But it is indeed what Bert says, a perturbative procedure in the vacuum expectation value of blowing up models.
Sure.
So but push these VABs to be of order compactification scale, right?
It is
believe both geometrically and in the skill theoretical description, continuous process that makes sense.
Yeah. And I cannot say much more, but
I completely agree with what you said. I think the main point to really understand these models, or to get a better theoretical understanding, as far as I can see it, is that you in fact see how you can, from the smooth situation, get to this singular point. And then what happens precisely there with all these singulars. That I find that very important. Because that is very unsatisfactory.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, my problem is if you do it the other way, if you go from Calabi-Yau to orbifold, then you, in a certain way, leave the regime of supergravity approximation. This is, I think, a bit problematic, right? I mean, so we start really with a string model, and okay, at the orbifold point, we fully control it, and now we do this expansion, and maybe this expansion breaks down or not, but at least we can claim that we do that. The other way seems to be, to me, even more dangerous, because you see, you all of a sudden leave the supergravity approximation which you started with in the first place. So
maybe one comment on that, you know, on geometric side, for 2.2 or before compactification, there is real matching on a metric blowing up. One can do that on geometric side precisely. So Yao showed that, how you can do that. By blowing up properly, Z2 singularity in those days. So geometric side is there for special orbifolds.
Mm-hmm.
your orbit folds are messier. Those are 0, 2s.
You don't even know exactly.
I fully agree. But also Gabriele worked on this, right? And other people are working. This is work in progress. I mean, of course, there's much to do, and you can maybe at the end fully understand.
Well, our main emphasis was that you had basically this smooth heterodic models and the heterodic orbifolds, and there seemed to be no connection whatsoever. And so if you blow up a heterodic orbifold, at least if you do it in six dimensions, the most simple way to understand it is that you have abelian bundles which are stuck at the fixed points. That's for K3 manifolds, that works fine, that you can immediately see what lives at which fixed point. It matches exactly with the number of moduli you expect from K3. Now with these four-dimensional models where Trapetti and Potibling and others continued, the problem is that obviously it's not possible to just associate abelian bundles. So you need some SU2 bundles at least also, so that's not very well understood at this moment. But I think the main issue was to understand, you have on the one hand the models by the Penn group, and they look so completely different from the heterodic orbifolds, but the reason is that you would, if you want to compare them directly, you should better start with some abelian bundles or SU2 bundles or so, but an heterodic orbifold would not look like an SU4 or SU5 bundle. But I fully agree that, I mean, you should only do a small blow-up. Afterwards, you don't trust stuff.
Yeah, but
if it gets older, if at certain reasonable order you get mass for singlets after blow-up procedure, right? This mass is directly then proportional to specific factors, so VEB over power, right? VEB to some power over
connectivity,
right? But basically, yes, it's small when VEB is small, right? Where you trust your field theory. But it's pretty good indication if you decouple from the spectrum, right? You did infinitesimal blow up, and
you can actually
mass
check.
Starts growing. So
you just check it, right? You
yeah.
find out what the blow up
the
is, and then you do the calculation.
In old days, when we did that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, just to follow up on Mary's question. So just concretely in your models, what's the scale of these depths relative to the string scalar complexity?
Well, it's a bit suppressed. We just assume that it is set by the Fayot plus term, which is, of course, maybe not justifiable because you have this deep left direction and you can have exceptionally large lefts in principle from field theory. Yeah? But then, of course, you would then perhaps lose perturbative control over the
construction. You expect to be several
orders? Just half an order of magnitude. So it's 0.3 or something like this. This is a typical left scale.
But I bet you have some completely flat directions.
No, not necessarily. No. I mean, now with this non-trivial vacuum configuration. Yeah, but the thing is, if you switch on many of them, they give mass to each other. It becomes more and more complicated, but we looked at, this was precisely the point of switching on 7 or 23 fields. We looked at these configurations and then looked at the curvature. And that, at least in this field space, there was no longer flat direction. And there was just this approximate R axiom, which is light, and the other things were much heavier. But to really prove that these points where F and D equations are satisfied are at such a point where all the singlets are small, you have to know these couplings, which I don't do. So you can just argue that we expect that this will happen, and now we want to prove that.
One thing you can know right away, if some of the fields in the spectrum, you know, come from different twisted sectors, you're pretty much forced to have
motion
suppressed.
Yeah, I know. I completely.
So that's additional suppression.
Sure.
Maybe it helps you in some cases. It may hurt you.
This moduli dependence might allow us in the end to stabilize T moduli as well. Once this field gets left, you see you have all this non-trivial superpotential. But I'm aware of this, of course. But still, I mean, there are other things. There's still a numerical coefficient. Apart from the T-dependence, which we now try to evaluate. I don't know, I'm not aware that anybody did it beyond order 4 so far. And that's what we're now doing. Yeah? I mean, we really want to get predictions, of course.
Yeah, I have some recollections during that. There were some surprises even, you know, from the CFT arguments about the strength of this order 1 coefficient.
Yeah. But we think we have now made some progress, but maybe not, I don't know.
May I also make a comment? So I was thinking about it. So for me, it's not so, is it so clear that the orbit folds are the boundary of the killer cone, of some, you know, geometric phase of the Calabi-Yau? Can it not be that it's more like these non-geometric phases which appear for general Calabi-Yau, so you have a linguistical model?
I don't
description.
Know.
So we are talking here like that it really lies on the boundary of a kilogram of some geometric phase. Yeah, I think, I mean, you have to completely see key construction. So there are B fields involved in this small cycle.
Sure, it might be that all this blowing up doesn't
work. So what we are looking here is more like for, yeah, to have this correspondence, like for linear sigma models, where you have a large Calabi-Yau regime, and then you have a number Gibbs-Cox regime. But you could have asked the same question there. What is the relation of the Gapner model to a large volume Calabi-Yau compactification? There the solution was, there's these intermediates, so this interpolating linear sigma model, which does the job. But it also points out that the Gapner model is not in a geometric regime.
Yeah, I'm not doing this blowing up so far.
No, that was just much. A suggestion. For me, it's not clear that.
Sure. So my
question is well posed by just asking.
Yeah.
No, starting at the original point and then
I think
going to the geometric region.
Well, the picture is clear. It's only 2.2 orbitals. Well, you really have also geometric way of blowing up.
Yeah.
For even asymmetric orbitals in old days of Hamidian bloodline. This question was already posed, but that may not be a geometric phase.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's really crystal clear, it's only for 2.2 and blow-ups there, because you have precise geometric limits as well. There is only this general geometric phase. But anything beyond that, any 0.2, it's probably, I think you're right, but that's probably a better way of thinking about the connection.
All I know is that people try to do that, and they have made some progress. But I mean, personally, I don't know.
They take the triangulations, which are correspond to geometric.
But I think that Michele and Stapon had some paper where they were looking at different kinds of shift vectors at singularities, and they had some classification. For some, it looked like locally like a Calabi-Yau. For some, they didn't find anything at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they might still try to find something else. But
yeah, actually,
maybe you can somehow distinguish that some models really you have a geometric phase, and for some others you don't.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
They are not really trying. I mean, they presented this model,
mm-hmm.
and they are now trying to find the blow up. And it's a messy thing, and I just dropped out of the collaboration because I cannot constitute anything reasonable. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So, my personal, I mean, I do orbifolds and expansion.
Well, this was not meant to be a question.
No, sure.
This was meant to be a general question for everybody.
Yeah, sure, sure, no, but it's a good point, and maybe there is.
We should go now for lunch. Thank you for this great presentation.
One more announcement is that due to the high